Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't
gamble.
I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel, NFL Week 8. Monday Night Football Edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
Good morning, buddy boy.
How are you doing this fine day, my friend?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Trying to figure out how we ended up with these two primetime games back to back. Dallas,
well,
Philly,
I mean,
and now.
We know the NFC East. We know the NFC East because of the East Coast bias always gets top fanfare and billing. It feels like every year, regardless of how good the teams are, we'll get the Eagles and Cowboys at least once on Sunday Night Football. And I don't think anybody paying in their wildest dreams would have anticipated that both those proud franchises would be the complete dumpster fires that they appear to be so far this season.
That was an ugly game last night. Very ugly. But I was happy the Eagles got a win.
I mean, it was good to see it, and they're still clearly the most talented team in the division, but my Lord, is Carson Wentz ever going to improve on his decision-making? I mean, I joked on social media, drunk Todd in college at 19 made better choices at 2 a.m. than Wentz does with the football sometimes.
Yes, there was some questionable decision-making processes going on there. He's trying to do too much, and I think that's kind of Doug Peterson's job to reel him in a little bit, especially as his weapons get back, right? You got Jalen Reagor back last night. Hopefully Miles Sanders returns. You had Goddard return last night. So I think that's the biggest thing when you're looking at Philadelphia, is hopefully they can start to get a little bit healthier. And that will at least allow Carson to play a little bit more within the offense, where he doesn't feel like he's got to do everything. There's a couple times last night, that pick in the end zone, I believe it was the second quarter, where he's rolling right, probably 7 or 8 yards in front of him. And in a game like that, when you're going against DiNucci, even a field goal is a big score there. So you just kind of threw away a possession there. I didn't understand that one. That was the one that had left me really scratching my head.
The one for me was honestly when he's scrambling around in the first quarter, and the Cowboys have kicked the field goal on their opening drive, and then Wentz, rather than throwing it away, takes the fumble. Now, credit to the Eagles' defense, they ultimately erased that turnover and kept DiNucci and company from putting points on the board. But just throw the ball away, live to fight another down. It's a little bit head-scratching knowing he has the talent. I do want to give the Cowboys credit, though, Payne. For the first time maybe in the last 4 or 5 weeks, they actually look like they were engaged. They showed energy. They showed a little bit of fight. They just flat-out didn't have the talent. They needed a quarterback to make that game slightly more competitive.
Yeah, it's for first place in the division. So it doesn't shock me. If they no-show there for first place in the division on national TV, then you probably have to start firing coaches, as crazy as that sounds.
Well, that may happen anyways. We'll see what direction the Cowboys elect to go. And, of course, Andy Dalton may have the chance to be back next weekend, where they'll take on the Pittsburgh Steelers, a game that most likely will not make our Thursday breakdown. But, you know, weirder things have happened in the past. Good, the bad, and the ugly, Payne. I don't know if you want to heap praise or accolades on your beloved Dolphins with a dominant performance against the Los Angeles Rams in Tua's debut.
Say what you would like to say. I'll let you go first. Go ahead. I'll give you the floor, because I know you weren't happy with the performance, which is fine. Understandable.
You watched the game in its entirety, and I always defer to you when it comes to all things Dolphins. I'll say in the first half, Tua obviously needed some time to acclimate, didn't like the way his ball security was on that opening strip sack that led to the Rams' first touchdown. But credit to Miami defensively, when they needed the turnovers, they needed the big plays. You get the 78-yard fumble return from Van Ginkel. You get Jakeem Grant with the punt return that breaks it wide open. But the offensive numbers, no, there was nothing pretty about it when you're out first down 31-8, and I know some of that came in garbage time for the Rams, but you failed to get 200 yards of offense. But I know there's one coordinator and coach in specific that you want to give a ton of credit to for that result.
Yeah, we can break this down, right? And I think Brian Flores obviously deserves all the credit in the world. And then you had Josh Boyer, the Dolphins DC, help with that game plan. And listen, this was part of the handicap for us, is that Brian Flores, with 2 weeks to prepare, similar to the time that he had in the Super Bowl, knew what he needed to do against Sean McVay and Jared Goff. And this is really the reason I found myself on Miami last week. And they did exactly what they did to Goff in the Super Bowl. And I know, again, the box score looks horrific, and the Rams probably deserved a little bit better. But if you look at Brian Flores, how he set the tone for this game defensively, he understood everything that we've talked about, Todd, for years, right? Goff melts under pressure. And you look at this right now. They forced the Rams out of their comfort zone, which is a lot of empty sets. They sent blitzes. And if you look, they forced Goff to survey the field from the pocket a little bit. None of the play action or the boot action, which allows Goff to kind of, you know, fake the handoff and then survey half the field. They couldn't really do that. So when I looked at what Flores did last night by some of these metrics and what I saw from my eyes, is they went cover zero. And Goff hadn't seen a bunch of cover zero this season. And you go back to 2019, Goff completed 43% of his passes against cover zero coverage. The first three quarters of that game, Goff was held to 4 yards per pass attempt, a 35% passing success rate. His completion percentage, 11% below expectation. And if you look, whether it was pressures or blitzes, I think that you hit it. Changed the entire game. Two picks, two fumbles for Goff. Emmanuel Ogba came out after the game and said, "We really liked our game plan here. The entire goal was to attack Jared Goff and the offense play downhill." That seemed to work pretty well. The problem was, though, and what you're going to hear from a lot of people, and they're right about it, was the offense. And this is something we didn't think would happen. So we got half the handicap right. Fortunately, we did get to the window. But 65% run on first down for the game, 63% run on first down the first three quarters is very predictable for Chan Gailey and the Dolphins offense. You would hope, it's something we talk about all the time, that a guy that's been around this long understands your quarterback's going to have to pass the ball at some point. You'd rather have him throw it on unpredictable downs rather than in these known passing situations. That's the best way. Have Tua complete a few balls early. Gain some confidence there. That never happened. But you can't pass less, right? And if that's the approach that you're going to have, you shouldn't have made this move. And I get Miami's offensive line has made some big strides there, but they're still 23rd in rushing efficiency as an offense. You can't run the ball more. And my feeling is, and the hope is, that you're going to have to see a more aggressive Miami offense this week. They're going to Arizona. Their defense spent 90 snaps on the field in the heat and humidity. But Chan Gailey, I think, needs to be dramatically better for this game against Arizona. It's probably not going to be a great road trip.
Yeah, you'd hope that there's a little bit of confidence building there. Tua finishes 12 of 22, 90-some-odd yards, and ultimately gets the win, which is most important, keeping heat on the Buffalo Bills within the division. We'll see how the Dolphins handle that bit of prosperity when they head west to take on a rested Cardinals side. Payne, I want to give a game ball to the Cincinnati Bengals, specifically their offensive line that was down 4 out of 5 starters. They kept Joe Burrow upright all game. We know the Titans don't exactly have the most ferocious pass rush, only 7 sacks through 7 games so far. But to the Bengals' credit, they took advantage of a great situational spot. There was very real professional money that came in on the road favorite, and the Bengals were arguably the better team from start to finish.
So I will let you praise the offense, but on my notes, I'm attacking Vrabel and the Titans' defense.
Oh, well, I think it's definitely a double-edged sword, and you know that we have been extremely critical of the Titans on the defensive side of the ball. I just wanted to see a glass half full for the Bengals, at least keeping their quarterback upright, because we knew throughout the week it gets increasingly difficult when you're down 1 cog, 2 cogs, right, 3, and 4 guys on the offensive line. But there's no doubt the Titans bear a brunt of the responsibility here for a piss-poor defensive game plan. Bad situational spot. You expected them to be a little bit flat, but that wasn't just a flat. That was a flat-out no-show.
Yeah, it was an absolute no-show, especially from the defense. And we can look at this, right? The Bengals were successful on 61% of their offensive snaps. Burrow was fantastic. 62% of his passes graded successful. And I know the yards per carry numbers don't look great for the Bengals offense, but there was a lot of timely runs. 59% of Cincinnati's runs were successful. If you look on third and fourth down combined, the Bengals converted 11 of 16. But you hit this perfectly. I think the bigger thing, Todd, is when you look at this performance by Tennessee's defense and put it in context, Cincinnati's missing 4 of its 5 starting offensive linemen, and Tennessee didn't record a single sack. The Bengals were missing Joe Mixon. There were 25-mile-per-hour winds, gusts approaching 40 miles per hour, and the Titans' defense allowed this rookie quarterback, right now, Joe Burrow, there's still two quarterbacks left to play, you know, this week. But Joe Burrow's completion percentage above expectation was the best of the week. 11% more of his passes he completed than were expected. And he did this with wind. Mike Vrabel right now is struggling as a defensive mind in Tennessee. And he's been struggling since week 10 of last year. So certainly praise Joe Burrow in the Bengals offense. But to me, four offensive linemen out, you can't record a sack.
Yeah, I mean, there's got
to
be
wind and weather, and you let a rookie quarterback have potentially the most accurate day of any quarterback in week 8. Like, give me a break.
Yeah, there's got to be a way that they can scheme up pressures. I mean, we talked about it all offseason, and you were on this well before a lot of folks talking about Jadeveon Clowney and this idea that he is somehow an elite rusher when all he does is he holds the edge as a run stopper. And people in Tennessee extremely disappointed that I don't believe he's recorded a sack so far this season. Vic Beasley had all sorts of drama about even his arrival to camp. He hasn't produced. And somewhere along the way, the Titans have to be scratching their head going, if we're going to be legitimate AFC contenders, we have to find a way to get to the opposing quarterback. Because when you play Big Ben, you play Patrick Mahomes. I'm not putting Lamar Jackson in that class, but any of the top-tier quarterbacks in the AFC seem to pick apart the secondary, especially given some of the holes that Tennessee has on the back end. So, not a
you're definitely not putting Drew Lock in that class, though.
No,
sure.
I'm definitely not putting Drew Lock. Although, you know, Denver fans,
I saw the comments.
My lord, like, Denver fans, for all of you that are out there listening, I love all of you like I love our fan bases, but let's not give Drew Lock all these accolades because he led a fourth quarter comeback against a Chargers team that blows leads faster than my mother did when I was a child, used to blow money at the grocery store.
Oh, you must have been a hungry kid.
No, she spent money there, so the fridge was always stocked. There was never a problem about finding snacks.
That's what I said. You were a hungry kid.
Yeah. So that happens at 160 pounds of romp and stomp and steal.
I will say this about Drew Lock. Talk about an irrational sense of confidence, which I think you have to like from the position. Even when he cut the lead down to, I believe, 3, he's out there going like cowboy gunslinger mode after probably the worst 3 quarters I've seen from a quarterback in a long while. So, doesn't seem to have a memory, which is good for the position. Get right back out there and chuck. So that was interesting. Now we kind of got sidetracked here. I forget what we were initially talking about.
Well, we were ripping apart the Tennessee Titans defense, yes, and you talked about elite passers and Drew Lock. But, I mean, at this point, honestly, for the good, the bad, and the ugly, it's not as though we script any of this or we have to adhere to logical breaks. So you can take the floor on whatever tangent you want. I'm going to sit here and listen and be entertained.
The one thing that's really interesting about Jadeveon Clowney, because now my mind's going back to where we were, is a very sharp fella, analytically sound, kind of broke down why Jadeveon Clowney doesn't get sacks, even though he gets loads of pressure. And the first thing is there's not much bend there. One thing you see from a lot of defensive ends, they're able to kind of like bend around the corner. He doesn't have any bend. And his best move is an inside move. And so quarterbacks can see it. And even though it's pressure, and pressure's good, they can get rid of it before they're actually being brought down. So that's kind of what was dissected of Jadeveon Clowney and why the pressures don't turn to sacks. Really interesting piece. Maybe I'll tweet it out later.
Makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, clearly he's not producing the way the Titans at least anticipated. We know that the Seahawks didn't want to pony up the cash, and rightfully so, as they continue to figure out what they need to do to bolster their particular pass rush. But in terms of good performances, whether it was team, individual, or coaches, Payne, what stood out to you yesterday?
I think Dalvin. In the Vikings, I think Dalvin probably had arguably the game of the day when you really look at it. Led Minnesota in rushing and receiving. Cook had 70% of the Vikings' total yards, all 4 touchdowns. If you go back and watch, too, and I know you did, Todd, but I'm talking to some of our listeners here. Sure, the scheme was good, but he was making guys miss, like left and right. It was ridiculous.
It was Barry Sanders-esque out there with Dalvin's ability to evade tacklers. And again, we pick on the Packers at great lengths. Some of that has to do with the Packers defensively, but I'm going to take nothing away. I'm taking nothing away from what Dalvin accomplished.
No, they can't stop the run, and that was part of why you saw that game go from 7 to a 5.5 close at a lot of sharp shops there because of the matchup. What was interesting to me, and it was a little stunning, is I think we have to give Zimmer some credit as well. Hasn't been the best season for him, but he made some good halftime adjustments. Packers offense, 41% success rate in the second half. That's without three starters in the secondary for Minnesota. So they were shorthanded, and I thought the defense played phenomenally in the second half, all things considered, building off Dalvin Cook's fantastic performance.
Yeah, especially when one of the defensive backs that started the game healthy was stretchered off with a head and neck injury in Cameron Dantzler. We'll see exactly what Minnesota will get back in the defensive backfield for this week's divisional game against the Detroit Lions. Payne, I want to give credit to Josh Jacobs for his very workmanlike effort in less than ideal conditions for the Las Vegas Raiders. Carried the ball 31 times, 128 yards. What impressed me most, he started to show some of that run angry style that made him so successful last year. He was dropping his shoulder, putting it into defenders, and really used his body running downhill to take advantage of a situation where, let's be honest here, the Raiders couldn't throw the ball all that successfully. The Browns sure as hell couldn't do it. So Jacobs ultimately became the X factor in getting a hard-fought win on the road in a suboptimal weather type scenario.
That was when we broke down the game. We said there's two things here. Like, 1A is which team's going to be able to run the ball better in this weather, because severe winds, 40 mile per hour gusts, you know, 28 mile per hour steady winds. Some even tracked it higher than that. They had the winds well into the 30s. So 1A was who's going to be able to run the ball. And 1B was which quarterback's going to be a little bit better with the short passes. And Josh Jacobs was an absolute beast. Got back to his running style. If you go back and watch that game, Todd, not only was he putting his head down, but he's like dragging defenders 3, 4, 5 yards after contact. All those yards really added up in a game like that. So huge performance there from Josh Jacobs. Got it done. The other one that I like to see, our boy got back on track there. DK Metcalf was someone that we...
What a horse.
Really, yeah, what a horse. The matchup was perfect, right? We talk about the kind of receivers that give San Francisco trouble with Richard Sherman out, and it's the outside receivers. And DK Metcalf, I thought, had a fantastic day, obviously. Rebounding off the worst game against Arizona, 10 for 161, 2 touchdowns on 15 targets. I thought what was really interesting, though, was like all the catches were meaningful. 8 first downs, 2 were touchdowns. Russell Wilson had a 151 rating when targeting DK, so good bounce back game. I think the other thing we have to give credit to here, Todd, is the Seahawks defense.
They played exceptionally well for 3 quarters. Then they did their best in the fourth to allow the 49ers to get back in the game to a certain extent.
Yeah, you know, listen, against a Kyle Shanahan offense, if you remove the junk in the fourth quarter where Nick Mullins comes in and Seattle's playing prevent defense because they're up 30-7, and you only focus on the first 3 quarters, Seattle defense holds Kyle Shanahan and the 49ers offense to 2.8 yards per play. First 3 quarters, San Francisco averages 3.2 yards per pass, 37% passing success rate, 0 explosive passes, and then they've had the timely pick there of Jimmy Garoppolo right around the red zone. So I thought it was a big day for the Seahawks defense, and at least for them, it looks like some reinforcements are on the way. Jamal Adams potentially inching closer to return, and then you get the trade for Carlos Dunlap. I would think he plays this week against the Buffalo Bills. So hopefully, for Seattle's sake and Russell Wilson's sake, they get a little help from that defense.
Yeah, I want to give them credit. I also was a little bit surprised San Francisco remains so run-heavy, knowing that they hadn't been able to establish the run against Seattle, and it plays into the strength of that Seahawks defense. And then you begin to wonder again how healthy Jimmy Garoppolo is. We know he went off to the locker room walking gingerly on that ankle. Be interesting to see if he's ready to go in a short week, and if the market's any indication, with Green Bay inching out to a 3-point road favorite at FanDuel, it leads me to believe that we may see Nick Mullins getting the start.
Absolutely. I would concur there. Yeah. You mentioned, listen, it's one of my bad things, and we can transition there. But, you know, Jimmy G's struggling, and that's why there really wasn't much confidence in throwing the ball. Even at the end of the second quarter there, right before halftime, I know San Francisco's backed up, but just handed the ball off and got out of Dodge. Typically, if you have a quarterback that's making as much as Jimmy G is, and you have Kyle Shanahan as an offensive mastermind, he's always going to be aggressive there. But he wasn't good. And if you just look, 37% passing success rate, 5.3 yards per pass attempt, 0 explosives, 1 pick, took 3 sacks. He just wasn't overly decisive with the ball either. Looked like he had some happy feet. He just doesn't look comfortable in the pocket. Accuracy has been off all season. I know he's battling this ankle injury, which is likely, I don't want to say for sure keeps him out, but likely keeps him out. Accuracy's been bad. Only Haskins and Darnold have a worse expected completion percentage than Jimmy G of quarterbacks with at least three starts. Jimmy G right now, 4% below expectation in terms of completion percentage. So he just hasn't been good.
Yeah, not the company you want to keep. And the 49ers dealing with the injury bug as well. More tests coming on George Kittle, who also exited that game early. We'll keep an eye on his status, but that'll be a
Tevin
game that we
Coleman
cover.
As well.
Yep, a game we cover in great detail on Thursday, which a game that should have been one of the marquee matchups. We'll see if the walking wounded are ready and able to go. Payne, I watched the Steelers-Ravens game in its entirety, or at least a better part of 3.5 quarters, and Baltimore builds a 17-7 lead despite Lamar Jackson throwing a pick six in the third play from scrimmage. You think that, okay, Baltimore's turned the corner, they've come forth with a good game plan. Lamar then gets picked to start the second half, creating a short field. The Steelers cut the game to 17-14, and the Steelers put together two of their only offensive drives, combined 18 plays for 150-some-odd yards in back-to-back series to get out of Dodge with a 28-24 win. Do we give the Steelers more credit for that win going on the road in a hostile territory in a very difficult spot to win that game outright? Or is this more a reflection of where Lamar Jackson, Greg Roman are on the offensive side, or this Baltimore Ravens defense that we had high expectations for that couldn't get a stop when they needed it most, albeit without Matthew Judon, who was unfortunately removed from the football game late in the first half?
So I'm going to go back and watch this game. I watched some of it. It was one of the games I had off to the side. It looks like it just came down to turnovers. Lamar Jackson needs to be better. We had the receivers calling him out a little bit after the game with Hollywood Brown.
Must run the family there, by the way.
So he seems to be better, right? You have the pick six to start the game, completely kills the momentum, has the pick in his own end, so it shut up two short drives. When you look at the numbers, though, they deserve better. 457 yards to 221. Outgained Pittsburgh by 1.4 yards per play. More yards per pass attempt. 2.6 more yards per rush attempt. So they have to figure out how to get over the hump and beat some of these better teams. And it has to be discouraging for a team with Super Bowl aspirations that the two best that you've faced on your schedule have beaten you in your own building. Now, I know the home field advantage isn't quite what it is this year, but that's certainly a blow to the confidence. They have to figure out how to get that mojo back, because right now they don't seem to have it. A lot of question marks. The pass game's got to get going. It's not just Lamar. Lamar certainly needs to be better, but he doesn't seem to have confidence in some of his guys. It's why they brought in Dez Bryant. They need to find that security blanket, because teams right now are just removing Andrews from the equation and saying, hey, beat us with some of your other weapons. And we saw Willie Snead get really implemented into this game because he's a decent route runner and a big target. Now, Willie Snead isn't very good, but he's the one guy who can kind of like sit down in a zone or run a decent route and have decent hands. He's supposed to be where he's supposed to be. Right now, there just isn't that chemistry with the young guys. I know Boykin did catch the touchdown, but between Boykin and Hollywood Brown, we certainly expected Lamar to be on a better page with those guys, and it just isn't the case right now. That's why you bring in Dez Bryant. Devin Duvernay starting to get acclimated a little bit more to this offense, better route runner. So we just need to get the offense humming a little bit. I'm surprised what it looked like out of the bye. I expected a little bit better. I expected a few more wrinkles. Just didn't quite see it. The saving grace is here. Dobbins appears to be the horse. I get Gus Edwards had a fine game, but Dobbins is a guy that can take the offense to a little bit different level. And even if Mark Ingram returns, we need to see more Dobbins, because I think he provides an extra element to this offense that it necessarily doesn't have, that punch, whether it's Gus or Mark Ingram.
Well, Dobbins will be turning to the scene of where he did plenty of damage in Big Ten championship games next week when the Ravens go on the road to take on the Indianapolis Colts. Payne, I don't even know where you want to go with the Chargers and Anthony Lynn. They lead 21-3 on the road in the division. You give up 21 fourth quarter points. You take a pass interference call with no time on the clock. Third game in a row where you blow a lead of 16-plus points. I mean, how long can you continue to endure all of this misfortune if you're the Chargers? Because if you look back, and if they're able to hold a lead against the Saints, against the Bucs, yesterday against the Broncos, suddenly this team is very much in the playoff discussion, and they have a couple of resume-building wins. But instead, here we are with a 2-5 record, or 2-6, I'm not quite sure, that doesn't reflect how well this team has played for extended stretches.
Chargers are the first team in NFL history to blow four straight leads of 16 points or more. Obviously, they did rally against Jacksonville, but lost the other three, as you alluded to. This is just who the Chargers are. Every year we talk about how talented they are and the weapons they have, and they either get hit with the injury bug and they lose games that they're substantial favorites in game to win. And this is just who they are. Anthony Lynn isn't my favorite coach. I don't think he's the most sophisticated. I don't think they do the best things. I mean, just tiny little things. Great. You went for it on 4th and 1 in the first half. Good decision. Well, we just run it up the middle with no lead back, and we're uncreative. You know, it's just... So, that's really the problem. Now, Justin Herbert was fantastic, but he does have the interception in the end zone. It's a poorly thrown ball inside when it needs to be outside. So, you lose a possession there. Then you do get a little bit conservative late, running the ball nonstop on first down, and I get it, you're chewing the clock. But you settle for 2 field goals. If you get a touchdown there, the game's over. So it's just a combination of things. I just don't think they're the best coach team. And they just need to start winning these games to get over the hump. And then you win a few of these, and your franchise changes a little bit. You know, it starts to ingrain in you. It's just an unfortunate thing because there's just so much talent here. But every year we do this. Finally, Todd, we just had to be like, we got to stop this. This is just insane. For whatever reason, they keep getting injured and can't win games they're supposed to. So that's just kind of where I'm at with the Chargers right now.
I mean, it's the only spot to look. I mean, it's a team that consistently becomes one of the best underdogs to back.
Yes.
Because you know they're going to invent ways to lose, but they're going to be competitive because their talent keeps them as such. But a franchise that you really can't look in the mirror and convince yourself it's a great idea to lay points, even though, obviously, when you're up 3 touchdowns on the road in the division, you think more often than not you're going to get you to the window to try and cover in that particular spot. Anything in the particularly...
Look at this, by the way. I mean, I'm pulling this up right now. You lose a game where in the first half you allowed 60 total yards. And Denver literally had a 13% success rate in the first half of that game offensively, 2.5 yards per play, did not record a single explosive in the first half. And you lose that game. It's just inconceivable, some of the things we've seen from the Chargers and the way they managed to blow these games.
You know, and that's after the Chargers get 2 momentum scores in the final 3 minutes of the first half when you think they've put the game on ice against the Broncos to go into the break up 14-3. But alas, it is the Chargers, and we should expect nothing until they go out there and prove that they can establish a winning culture. Anything in the particularly negative fashion as far as bad or ugly that stood out to you before we shift gears and start to focus on some of the look-ahead numbers?
No, I mean, I think that was it. I think we did a good job covering the weekend that was. Anything for you stand out?
No, I mean, those were some of the main things. Again, you know, we look at a lot of these teams and try and figure out what their identity is going to be going forward. I want to give the Falcons credit for their performance on Thursday night. They were better defensively than I think a lot of us anticipated in a game that saw some over money dealing with the injury to Calvin Ridley, but survive in a road environment. Now some extra time to prepare for a game this weekend against Denver. The Detroit Lions, a little bit disappointing. I know Kenny Golladay left that game with an injury. But some of these same franchises, they just can't maintain a level even keel. They get up 1 week, and they inevitably come crashing back to earth. So it's what separates the good from the bad and why we have the haves and the have-nots in the National Football League. And speaking of which, obviously provides a good segue into just 2 look-ahead lines that I think are worth touching, both involving teams hailing from the NFC North pain. We talked a little bit earlier in the show about Green Bay and San Francisco. This number right now, you're looking at Green Bay inching closer to a 3-point favorite at FanDuel. Look ahead number here with San Francisco -1. Safe to assume more injury related than anything else because neither team did anything to knock your socks off yesterday.
Yeah, it's injuries to Garoppolo and Kittle and Tevin Coleman. And that's basically, we'll have to monitor what those situations look like. And it would appear that this was a game that Green Bay was really focused on, because they no-showed for the most part. Aaron Rodgers wasn't very good yesterday in a lot of senses. Missed some wide-open guys. But this is the one that I think they've had circled This was their get right game. I'm surprised it's in San Francisco. They played in San Francisco last year during the regular season. Obviously, they traveled there for the playoff game because they had the worst record. But you got pummeled. You got embarrassed twice by the 49ers last season. And this is kind of the game that they've had circled. This was the spot for Green Bay. I think we were hoping, after we saw all that steam on Sunday, taking the game from 3 to as much as I saw at one point that San Francisco was favored -1 at Pinnacle there. So I was hoping that this was going to set up nicely for us, even with the long travel on a short week. But we'll see what comes of the San Francisco injuries. But yeah, this is why the move happened. I think Green Bay is the spot. I think, you know, obviously with Garoppolo and Kittle potentially out, there's that's a massive downgrade.
Yeah, it'll change what San Francisco can do on the offensive side of the ball, for sure. The other game that we saw, a modest move, albeit through a key number, you saw the Minnesota Vikings, a 2-point favorite playing host to Detroit Lions at FanDuel on the look-ahead number. That number out to 3.5, even seeing some 4s out there. I mentioned the Kenny Golladay injury, but for me, Payne, this feels like a upgrade of Minnesota as far as public perception is concerned in the wake of their win against Green Bay, and of course, a slight downgrade of the Lions, who lost by 20 points to the Indianapolis Colts.
It'll be really interesting to see where this number goes, because we know there's been some professional money backing the Vikings, and, you know, started in the Tennessee game once that got to 3. And we've seen them take some money from professionals, you know, pretty routinely since that time. You had the Sunday night game against Seattle, this week against the Packers. Minnesota seems to be a buy-on team from a lot of the professionals. And now you're looking at this line, as we talk, Todd, even out to 4. So you have the move right off these two drastically different performances, where Minnesota at 1 point, 7-point dog, wins the game outright. Detroit, 3-point dog at home, gets blown out by 3 scores. But the big thing here is the Kenny Golladay situation. Injured his hip. We'll have to monitor that. I'm not sure how high this gets. And it seems like some guys are getting out ahead of this line move. But I don't know ultimately what's going to end up being the side. We'll have to wait and see. And it'll probably change if Golladay's in for this one.
Yeah, time to do a little bit digging on that one. But still, a handful of days away before we ultimately have to make a proclamation in terms of where that number will go, where it'll settle, and ultimately who becomes the true side. But a game we don't have that luxury for, Payne, takes place tonight at MetLife Stadium, where it's the New York Football Giants welcoming in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And your numbers at FanDuel on this particular game, well, they're not all that competitive, at least on paper, with Tampa a 12.5-point favorite. Total on the game sits at 45.5, and when you look at the way Monday Night Football has played out this season, blindly backing the underdog has produced a win-loss record of 5-3 against the spread. Under has produced at a 6-2 record, 75% clip. Meanwhile, the New York Giants, well, they haven't exactly been dynamic in their own building, compiling a record of 3-15 against the spread the last 18 home games. Extra time to prepare for the Giants. Tampa, of course, had to travel across the country to take on the Vegas Raiders back home, dealing with an offensive line, at least against them, that has had some COVID issues. And, of course, you have Joe Judge's level of familiarity with Tom Brady. So I guess, Payne, when we look at this Bucs offense matched up against the Giants defense, Tom Brady has clearly found his stride. Do the Giants have the answers to slow down this now balanced Tampa Bay offense?
You said the Giants aren't good at home, huh?
No, the Giants are not a good football team playing their own building. They could have played these games
on Mars. I don't know if they're good anywhere.
I mean, they have been outstanding as road underdogs over the last, I don't know, couple of seasons. So I don't want to discount that when it comes to a wagering perspective.
They were an absolute monster with Eli on the road as a dog. That's for sure. You mentioned some of the familiarity. Yes, you know, you have Joe Judge. And I remember vaguely, I believe, he was appointed the wide receivers coach last year in New England. He's typically the special teams guy, but I think they added wide receivers to his list of tasks there. And reading this little clip from him, and he said that he really got to see how Tom Brady handled things. He was able to hear how Tom would, you know, pick the brains of his receivers throughout practice and in the film room, and to see what they saw pre-snap and to see what Tom saw pre-snap. So there is like this direct familiarity here. It's not just like two guys that were, you know, in the same organization, but they were in the same meeting room. So I think obviously that could play a little bit of a role here. In terms of the Giants defense and the Bucks offense, listen, it's clear the Giants defense has improved year over year, right? They've added a couple pieces in free agency in the draft. I think the scheme is a little bit better. You have Patrick Graham as the DC. He's a Belichick and Flores disciple. So they play a little more organized this year, that's for sure. If you've looked, Giants do a really good job stopping the run. 11th in defensive rush efficiency, I believe 9th in rushing success rate defense. Not as good against the pass, but the one thing the Giants have done a good job in terms of pass defense, and it's probably by design, they do a good job keeping things in front. 5 explosive, 5th in explosive pass defense. So doing well there. And there's this little staple of the Belichick bend but don't break. Giants do a good job in the red zone. They make teams settle for 3 points pretty frequently. 6th in red zone defense. The question here is, you know, step up in class, obviously, for the Giants defense. They faced the 7th easiest schedule of offenses, and you go through the quarterbacks. Big Ben is fine, but it's his first game in over a year. You get Trubisky, you get Nick Mullins, you get Goff and Kyle Allen. So, obviously, Brady and the Buccaneers offense is going to be a little bit of a challenge here, but you get no Chris Godwin. That helps. And the spot isn't the best. You know, you get this huge Packers win. You travel across the country to Las Vegas, and then you get the huge division game with revenge on deck against the Saints next week. I think if this were probably like a regular Sunday game, Todd, not in prime time on a Monday, I think we'd probably see a little bit more money gravitate here towards the Giants. Maybe a little value bet. I don't know. But for me, I'm looking at this, and I'll be candid. We made the game 10.9. The matchup isn't great. You're obviously dealing with some of the COVID issues, as you hinted at there. And that's part of the biggest part of this matchup, is where the COVID issues have hit. So at 12.5 here, there's not enough value. I pray that it doesn't get to 14. But the key, though, I think, when you look at this game, right, is can Daniel Jones hold on to the ball? That's what it's going to come down to.
I mean, it's a great question because it's something he hasn't been able to do all that regularly. And when you look at this Giants offense, Daniel Jones being the leading rusher may not ultimately be the recipe for success against this Todd Bowles-led defense that's been downright outstanding this season. Payne, third-ranked defense overall, best against the run, surrendering an average of 66 rushing yards per game, second in total sacks, 88 pressures as a team. They've now given up 20 or fewer points in 5 of 7 games, and when you look at their pass defense, which was a question mark coming in, passer rating has been shored up a little bit, allowing top 10 in that department and 7 yards per pass attempt. I do have to give the Bucs a ton of credit as they're getting production out of some of their draft picks right out of the gates, whether it's Antoine Winfield's immediate impact in the secondary, Tristan Wirfs, who rates out the best rookie offensive lineman right now and what they're seeing there, or even Tyler Johnson, who may be the beneficiary of Chris Godwin's absence since tonight's game, even if he's out a little bit longer dealing with that broken finger.
Yeah, they've drafted really well. And the one thing that we're looking for here is part of this, the matchup that everyone should be focused on. In normal weeks, Thursday is your final big practice day. And because of the COVID issues, the Giants only had 4 available linemen for their Thursday practice. So Eric Tomlinson, which is a backup tight end, had to play right tackle. And they used defensive linemen as offensive linemen for the scout team. So it looks like most of these guys are going to be back aside from Will Hernandez. But most of them haven't practiced this week. And you're now going against Tampa defense. That's the most blitz-heavy team in the NFL. 43%. Bucks are also 2nd best in pass rush win rate and pressure rate. And the one thing that Daniel Jones, you feel bad for the kid. I actually think, and I know a lot of Giants fans will disagree, but he's just been like, the deck's been stacked against him. The poor kid's been pressured on 44% of his dropbacks in his entire career. Same thing this year, 44%. Got guys dropping balls all over the place. The weapons are in and out of the lineup. And then they hire an offensive coordinator that's an absolute dud. So I feel bad for Daniel Jones. But this game, again, is going to come down to him holding on to the ball. And this is why a lot of Giants fans aren't waiting around for Daniel Jones, I don't think. If you look, he's got 23 fumbles and 19 interceptions in 19 starts. That can't happen if you're on the underdog or the under here, which seem to be the sides, right? Can't have short fields. Punts are fine. They're your friend in a game like this if you're taking the dog or the under. You can't just give away points. And I think that's what this game's going to come down to. If Daniel Jones can just hold on to the ball and not set up short fields, the Giants will make this relatively competitive, and it'll probably come under the total. The place where they need to attack here is if Tampa is going to be their normal blitz-happy self here, you have to make them pay with your tight ends and running backs catching the ball. And for having two great linebackers, right now Tampa's allowed 80% of running back targets to be caught, 7.6 a completion, giving up 11 yards of reception to tight ends and 3 touchdowns. So if they are going to blitz, and who knows if they need to, right? Like Sue and JPP returning to the Giants, they might be able to get a natural pressure here. And if that's the case, then the Giants are going to struggle. If you can at least force Tampa to blitz, you might have a shot over the middle passing to your running backs and tight ends.
You know, Giants,
the matchup isn't good here, Todd. I'll just put it that way.
You know, Giants fans have heard this forever. Well, all we need is a healthy Evan Ingram, and he's finally going to break through. Somewhere along the way, Evan Ingram, this prospect that all of us thought could be an elite-level pass-catching tight end, hasn't materialized into much of anything. You wonder when it's going to happen, but routinely performs in that 30 to 40-yard range. And when you look at the Giants' stable of backs, I'm not quite sure who you want to lean on the most, Wayne Gallman or Deion Lewis, to be that breakout candidate.
You forgot the pride of FAU, who's going to be on the active roster in Alfred Morris tonight.
How many carries do you think Alf gets today? If I set the over-under at 4.5, I mean, how heavily do I have to juice the under?
I'm not quite sure there. Not quite sure. But so, yes, it'll be Wayne Gallman getting the lead role, and you'll have some Deion Lewis sprinkled in there, and maybe a little Elf action.
And this, of course,
is just,
on the other...
this is one of those games, like, you know, you have to plug your nose here if you're on the Giants. You're just saying, hey, there's value in the number here. You have the look-ahead spot to the Saints. 10.9 should be the number. Again, 12.5 doesn't get me there. I'd probably have to value bet it if it got to 14.
Can I interest you in a 13.5? Can I interest you in a 13?
I'd probably need 14 just to throw a value bet. And listen, I hate even saying this just because it's really cheesy and corny. I got this number thing, I got this number. At 48, this game was extremely sharp under. Let's just put it that way. And then there was another group that came in and took 47.5, 47. It's why it got sent down to 46 and 45.5. And we're sitting here at 45.5 and 45. So the under is very sharp. Now, obviously, a lot of numbers have since passed. But, you know, if you can get the Buccaneers out a little bit here and they turn to the ground and pound in the second half, we've seen some of their games, Todd. Denver comes to mind, playing a similar lackluster offense with a good run defense, where Tampa Bay just kind of bleeds out the clock in the second half, knowing that there's a important game on deck. I actually almost prefer the full game rather than the first half. So, I don't have anything at the current numbers.
All good. I was going to say, I mean, they do have two healthy running backs. We saw Leonard Fournette get heavily involved in the offense, 11 carries for 50 yards last game. Only the second time all season he's had double-digit in carries. Ronald Jones was pretty ineffective against the Raiders. Only 34 yards. It broke a string of 3 straight 100-yard efforts. So they do have a stable of backs that are more than capable of grinding the clock down should they build a double-digit lead, like you kind of mentioned, and just getting out of Dodge so they can focus on Sunday Night Football, where they'll have that revenge date with the New Orleans Saints. A game that we will break down in extended depth in detail right here on the Bet the Board podcast come Thursday morning. All right, Payne, anything else? Well, hold on. First things first, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. I should really get better about introducing that earlier in the show, but I figure all of our loyal listeners already have us muted on social media, so they don't need to get banged in the head with anything that we have to say on that particular medium. Anything else that we left out of this fine Monday program that you'd like to include before we reconvene for the National Football League 72 hours from now?
No, that's it. And then obviously back on Wednesday for college football. Some big games this week.
I say, admit it, you're actually excited for college football. I mean, don't lie. Tell the people what they want to hear, Payne.
I was just trying to be nice and get you a little happy feeling below the belt before we leave, implementing college football talk on an NFL podcast.
I can't wait for you to tell everyone that listens to this show regularly how soft the Pac-12 is when their season will get jump-started on Saturday, and how you're going to elect to break down breakfast football at its finest with Arizona State and USC kicking off at the Coliseum at 9 a.m. Pacific time, because as we know, it's all about the student athlete. It has nothing to do with TV dollars and revenue.
I don't know if I'm going to talk about that game, but do you West Coast guys, are you able to wake up that early? I mean, the rest of the planet is functioning, right? Making big dollars and acting as normal humans. Are you guys up that early?
All right, asshole. You do realize there's a three-hour time difference, and so it's a little bit different on the body clock. Mr. Circadian Rhythm himself. I mean, if you're a football player and you're playing at 9 a.m. local time, what time are you getting up for your pregame meal? I mean, are these guys practicing at 6:30, 7 a.m.? I mean, are they going to the buffet at 5:30 with these COVID protocols, or is this the grab-and-go where you hit the local Dunkin' Donuts and you grab a mochaccino before you get to the locker room and get yourself ready to play?
I don't know. Probably wake up about 4:30.
Yeah, I'm interested. Let's say it this way. I'm interested to see how that total gets bet down specifically in the first half. All right. Enough damage for one Monday morning. We've broken down the Giants and Bucks to the best of our abilities. And just wait. A week from today, we'll go right back to the scene of the crime at MetLife Stadium and get to talk Patriots Jets. Yay.
I do wish I lived on the West Coast in terms of like these late games. That's the only benefit. That's the only benefit to living out your way.
I don't mind getting up early in the morning. It's not something that really fazes me. Obviously, if you're a night owl, it's not conducive when you have to be up at, you know, 5:30-ish in the morning on Saturdays and Sundays, especially during college basketball season and whatnot, to make sure you have your ducks in a row. But there's a little bit of breath of fresh air when Monday Night Football ends before 9 o'clock Pacific time, and you at least have an hour or two to unwind before you have to tap out, or for old people that are on this podcast like you that'll like to go to bed at halftime.
I would like to go to bed at halftime tonight. That would be the goal.
So, well, I mean, if once you get your 14 on the New York Giants and you have to value bet, you might not be able to go to sleep at halftime.
I sure hope it doesn't get there.
For Payne Insider, I'm Todd Furman. Best of luck with however you choose to wager on the Bucks and Giants tonight. We'll be right back with you on Wednesday for a massive college football slate. But in the meantime, hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.